Okay. So maybe this is apropos of Purim, a little bit of a lighter topic, but it emerges from a lighter incident, which is that maybe a month or two ago, the CRC put on its Facebook page, really unbeknownst to me, a photograph of my drinking soapy detergent-laden water in order to make a determination of whether it satisfied the Nosim Tam Lefgama test, that this would be water that was putrid or spoiled or detrimental enough that it could be used for kashering purposes. We'll get to that in a moment. And it was posted. Somebody took the picture. I didn't even know I was being photographed. But I was sitting together with Rabbi David Cohn, who's also in this picture. We have a color photo. We were making this taste test determination together. And somebody else in the room snapped a photograph. I did not know. And it was then posted on the COC Facebook page. And apparently it generated a lot of interest. Let's use the word interest. It generated a lot of interest. And a couple of people, including Rabbanim, asked me to clarify what exactly was going on over here. Why were we trying to kill ourselves? I figured that maybe this would be a good subject for a shiur. If you look on the table here, you could see that there are different bottles and different solutions of water. And there's even a Coca-Cola on the table. If you look very closely, next to where I'm sitting. So people asked, why did you have the Coca-Cola on the table as well? So I thought this would be an opportunity to speak a little bit about the subject of Nosim Tam Lefgam. What does it mean to have a taste that's a spoiled taste, and why is that important from a kashrus perspective? I actually entitled this year, What Were They Drinking? The CRC bad taste test. So was this in bad taste or just a test regarding, you know, bad taste? I'll let you, you know, decide that on your own. Specifically, the solution of water that was being tested was a solution that was deemed to be equivalent to that which you would typically find in a dishwasher. There's a tshuva by Rav Avadya Yosef, in which he is very magal about using the same dishwasher for meat and dairy dishes. Some would say that the simple reading of his argument is that you could even wash the dirty meat and dairy dishes at the same time. Based on halacha in Shulchan Aruch and Simon Tzadi Hei, which the Mechaber brings, that says that if you're soaking meat and dairy dishes in a large bowl at the same time and you have soapy water in the large bowl, even if it's very hot, it's a Yad Seledis bowl type of temperature that would normally transmit a taste from one type of utensil to another utensil. Nonetheless, in this case, it's going to be permissible because the taste is going to be a bad taste. It's going to be a rancid test, what we call Nosim Tam Lefgam. There's a machlokis between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Shimon in the Gemara as to whether Nosim Tam Lefgam is mutter or not. If I have a food and it receives a detrimental taste, I could have two nice tasting foods. I can have two nice tasting beverages. I can have milk and orange juice. And I have one that goes into the other. And one is prohibited, for whatever reason, it's a forbidden type of food, and the other is permitted. But the prohibited food goes into the permitted food in a way that the permitted food tastes detrimental. It tastes not as good as it would have otherwise. It doesn't have to be completely unfit for human consumption. It just has to be made partially detrimental. So we say that technically speaking, that's mutter. That's the halacha of Rabbi Shimon, that we pass on to Rabbi Shimon. Nosim Tam Lefgam is mutter. There are two different types of Nosim Tam Lefgam. One Nosim Tam Lefgam is if you have, let's say, a little bit of forbidden taste that goes into a permitted food. So normally, if I didn't have shishim, if I didn't have 60 times the measure of the forbidden food in the permitted mixture, so then the entire mixture is going to become usa. That's based on the principle of Tam Kirkud Daraisa. That if there's a taste that's transmitted from the forbidden food into the permitted food, even though normally we say Achari Rabim Lahatos, that we follow the majority, so the majority is permitted, the whole thing should be permitted. Nonetheless, there's a rule we generally assume, like the opinion of Tosfos, that this is a rule on a Daraisa level, that if the forbidden food transmits a discernible taste, meaning I don't have 60 times the measure of permitted food, so then that's going to be prohibited. It's not going to be nullified based on the principle of majority because of Tam Kirkud Daraisa. But if I don't have a good time, I don't have a good taste. Tam means taste. Ke'ikra means that it's like the essential part of the food. So if I don't have a good taste, because it's a nosein tam lefgam, it's a bad taste, it's a detrimental taste, so then I don't apply this principle of tam ke'ikra. If I don't apply the principle of tam ke'ikra, I go back to my original principle. What's the original principle? That is batul barov, that the forbidden taste could be overridden, would be nullified by the permitted food. So therefore it would be permitted in such a case. That's one case of nosein tam lefgam. I assume that's the way the nosein tam lefgam works, that essentially what's being re-triggered is this notion that the food becomes batul barov. Once I have nosein tam lefgam, I nosein tam ke'ikra d'oraisa, so if I would have an issur mashu, if I would have a type of food that would not become nullified by majority, because I say even the tiniest little amount is going to prohibit the mixture, so then I'm not going to be lenient with respect to nosein tam lefgam. When would this come out? This would be relevant with respect to Pesach. If you had chometz mixture, and you had that got mixed on Pesach, Rav Shechter likes to give the example, they used to poison the wells. Not literally poison the wells, but you had anti-Semites, sometimes non-Jews, sometimes Jewish anti-Semites, that would effectively, quote-unquote, poison the wells on Pesach. They would put breadcrumbs in the wells on Pesach. So the breadcrumbs, they would become kavush. They would sit there for 24 hours so they can transmit the taste. So then you wouldn't be able to drink the water on Pesach. However, the breadcrumb, the water, it becomes, if you would have a transmission of taste from breadcrumbs into water, people usually like their water to be unadulterated. They like it to be pure. They like it, like this. They like it to be Perrier, they like it to be very, very pure water. Like the type that Reuven Gottesman brings for me every single Monday night. Thank you very much. So therefore, they don't want it to be adulterated with chometz crumbs. So if it's adulterated with chometz crumbs, that's going to be nosein tam lefgam. So therefore, maybe that should be permissible on Pesach, just like it's permissible the rest of the year. So the Mechaber says, yeah, that would be permissible. We could be meiko, we could be lenient with respect. He says, in general, we could be lenient on Pesach with respect to nosein tam lefgam. Apparently, the Mechaber held like those we showed him, said that the way that nosein tam lefgam works is through a different mechanism, not a mechanism per se that it's considered like it's batul barov, but rather, what was the source for Rabbi Shimon's halacha, that nosein tam lefgam is considered to be okay? So he learned it from the case of from a nevela, that we say that if you have a nevela, you're not allowed to eat a nevela, which is a carcass of an animal that dies. So the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, Daf Samach Zayin Mabeis, says that Rabbi Shimon derived from a nevela that it says, Lo sochlu kol nevela, you can't eat a dead carcass of an animal, wasn't shechted properly, what do you have to do with it? Agera sher b'sharecha titanen v'achala. You give it to a ger toshav, you give it to a non-Jew who has accepted upon himself the seven mitzvahs of B'nai Noach, he has a higher status, but he's not Jewish, he doesn't have to eat kosher, so you can give it to the non-Jew. From this, the Gemara derives, Rabbi Shimon derives, Kulavuya Lager Kuya Nevela. When is it considered to be prohibited? When it's something which is eligible to be given to a non-Jew to eat. But if it wouldn't be eligible, because the non-Jew would say, ick, I don't want to eat that. It's yucky. It is not fit for human consumption. It's Enavuya Lager. So then it's not considered to be prohibited. So that's a case of, because it's so yucky, it's such a nosein tam lefgam, so then that would be permissible. That's where Rabbi Shimon derives the halach of nosein tam lefgam. Rabbi Meir disagrees with him, says, no, that's only if it was putrid to begin with, but not if it was originally edible, and then it became putrid. So, but we assume like Rabbi Shimon, no. Even something that was originally edible, and then it became putrid, if it received a detrimental taste, it's going to be also based on the principle of nosein tam lefgam. So some Rishonim say that that's the idea of nosein tam lefgam, that if you have a little bit, you have a mixture of food, and in that mixture you have a detrimental taste, so that's considered to be ein aroy lager. I can have two forms, two ways in which a food becomes viewed as inedible. Either I have an entire unit of food that has to become completely inedible, or I have a taruvis. I have a permissible food that gets mixed together with a little bit of a forbidden food, so it's now a mixed together food. So then even if it's a begima porta, even if it becomes a little bit of a detrimental taste, that's also considered to be like it's inedible. So then it's not the heter, according to that svara, according to that rationale, it's not based on an issur mashu. It's not based on the fact that It's not the heter. It's not based on bittul barov. It's not based on the fact that that the yisur becomes nullified. It's based on the fact that the yisur is that the item is not considered to be edible altogether. So if it's not considered to be edible altogether, so you might apply that heter even on Pesach. So that must be the svara of the mechaber. But the Ramah seems to hold, like the simple understanding of nosing tam lefgam when I'm dealing with an actual food, that the idea is that when it comes to nosing tam lefgam, I say I have a little bit of iser and it contributes a detrimental taste. So it's considered like it's nullified by the majority of the heter, and I don't apply the principle of natam kikir deraisa, and therefore it's considered permissible because it's nullified by the majority. So on Pesach, we don't nullify anything based on majority. Even a tiny, teeny little bit of chumetz is considered to be aser. So therefore, we understand the opinion of the Ramah, that the Ramah says that that would be prohibited on Pesach. There's another type of nosing tam lefgam. The other type of nosing tam lefgam, all of this is covered in various measures by the sources in front of you. The other type of nosing, the main sugya of nosing tam lefgam is in Avodah Zorah, daf ayin vav amin aleph. And then in Avodah Zorah, Daf Samach Zayin Amud Beis, gives you the machlokas between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Shimon. So the other type of Nosing Tam Lefgam is discussed in the Sugya later on Avodah Zorah. And Ayin Heim Beis, the Ayin Vav Amud Aleph, first source that I mentioned. So that speaks about if I have a prohibited taste, let's say that I cook inside of a inside of a pot. And the pot then hasn't been used in 24 hours. It hasn't been used in 24 hours. So we say, I have a kedera she'ena bas yoma. I have a pot that has, it was used to cook forbidden food. It was used to cook forbidden food. Or maybe it was used to cook permitted food. It was used to cook dairy, and now I'm cooking meat in it. But it hasn't been used in 24 hours. So then I say that whatever taste was embedded in the walls of the pot is nosing tam lefgam. When it comes out, it's just going to contribute a prohibited flavor. It's going to contribute a detrimental flavor. It's not going to be prohibited because it's going to be only a detrimental flavor. And therefore, it's not going to forbid. If it was forbidden food, it's not going to forbid the permitted food that I cook after 24 hours. If it was dairy, it's not going to forbid the meat that I cook after 24 hours because it was a detrimental taste that was inside of the walls of the pot. So with respect to this idea of what was inside the walls of the pot, so there's a Tosos in Chulin Daf Ches Amud Beis that points out you have these two different types of Nosein Tam Lefgam. Tosos seems to indicate that they would work based on the same mechanism. Whatever's the mechanism to permit a type of food that has a mixture in it that causes the food to, that's a forbidden mixture, that's only a minority of the mixture that causes the entire food to be detrimental in taste. So whatever reason we permit that, we would also permit the case of a forbidden absorption that was in a pot, and then I cook in that pot 24 hours later. There's a shita of Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam that seem to indicate that I don't necessarily need 24 hours, even if it was one night, even if it was left for an entire evening, from the beginning of the evening until the very end of the evening, and now it's the next morning, and it's only 12 hours later, or 10 hours later, or 14 hours later, depending on the time of the year. Then that would be good enough for us to assume that whatever taste is transmitted is a detrimental taste. But even Rabbeinu Tam says, Hamach mitzav olav bracha, that it's appropriate to assume that you really need a full 24 hours. That's the opinion of the Rosh, it's the opinion of the Rosh Bab, and that's the way that we paskin in Shulchan Aruch and Yoredei Asim and Kuf Gimel, that we generally require 24 hours. Sometimes for purposes of various halachos or very dire b'di'evit situations, will take into account the opinion of Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam that you don't need a full 24 hours. Maybe you just need the passage of a night, but we generally assume that you need the passage of 24 hours. So that there is a separate discussion as to whether the reason that you have an absorption inside of a utensil, inside of a pot, why that wouldn't prohibit the food when I cook the food 24 hours later. There's a separate discussion. Is that really for the same reason? If I assume, like the Ramah, for example, that the reason Nosing Tam Lefgam generally would be permissible is because it works through Bittul Barov, do we say the same thing over here as well? That whatever taste was absorbed in the pot, when it's going to go and then be conveyed into the food that I cook 24 hours later, it's going to be absorbed in the food, but because it's a detrimental taste, so I say that it is nullified by the majority of the mixture. Do I say, no, here for sure, after 24 hours, it's going to be such a detrimental taste. It's not like food anymore. It's just an absorption inside of a pot. So here, for sure, it's considered like a nevela. Like it's considered like it's not right lachila. Like it's not edible altogether. So maybe there's more room on Pesach, for example, to be makel, to be lenient with respect to this type of situation. If you cooked on Pesach in a chometz stick a pot, you heated up some water in a pot that it turns out was used to cook spaghetti. Somebody wasn't so good at putting away the pots before Pesach, or they put away the pots and the tape that was on the cabinet came off, or somebody saw that there was tape on the cabinet and thought, oh, that's weird that there's tape on the cabinet, and just opened the cabinet anyway and took the pot and cooked the food. All of these things have been known to happen, and then discovered that this was a chometz stick pot. So is the food or the hot water, whatever, that was cooked inside, is that going to be okay? Maybe in this case there's more room to be mekel. So the Ramah, not in the Shulchan Aruch, but in the Darchei Moshe, he says, no, we're machmir in this case as well. Okay, so all those cases, we're machmir when it comes to Pesach. Because we assume that maybe the heter is based on that it's really just a nullification of a majority. Now, how does this relate to situations of kashering? Well, we say that if I have let's say that I have a pot that wasn't used in 24 hours, and it had previously been used for non-kosher food, and now I cook something in it. So the food itself I'm allowed to eat, but we say the pot I still have to kasher. Why do I have to kasher the pot? Everything I cook in that pot afterwards, almost everything, there's davar charif, there might be an exception, certain exceptions, but generally speaking, whatever I cook in the pot is going to be permissible, so why do I have to kasher the pot? So the Gemara in Avodah Zarah says that I make a gezerah. It's a gezerah, kedera she'enem bas yoma, mishum kedera bas yoma. That I'm afraid that a person's going to use a pot that was not 24 hours old, since it was used with non-kosher, or I'm going to use a pot that was previously used with meat, and use it with dairy even before 24 hours expires. So therefore, that's why I have to kasher the pot, even though I'd be allowed to eat the food. The Tosfos goes further and says that I'm makel with respect to the food, because the food never started out as usser. The pot started out as usser, because the pot, when it was within the 24-hour period, so it had the susceptibility of being usser. If it was a forbidden utensil, then for sure it was usser. So that's why I have to kasher the pot. But either way, I have to kasher the pot, even though it's past 24 hours. But if it's past 24 hours, I have the advantage that whatever taste was absorbed in the walls is going to be pogum, so therefore I'm able to avert another issue. What's that issue that I'm going to avert? And this is what Tosfos points out in Maseches Chulin on Daf Kuf, Daf Kuf and Aleph going on Daf Kuf and Beis, going on to Daf Kuf Aleph and Aleph. I have a principle of Chaticha Nases Nevela. What does Chaticha Nases Nevela mean? It means that let's say that I have meat and dairy, and some milk goes into the meat. I have a piece of meat, and the piece of meat doesn't have the volume of 60 times the milk, so now this piece of meat is considered to be 100% usur. If this piece of meat now falls into a chulent with lots of pieces of meat, and I have 60 times the amount of meat to counteract the amount of milk that originally fell into the first piece of meat, everything is going to be usur anyway, unless I have 60 times the amount of meat in this chulent pot to counteract the one piece of forbidden meat that had already gotten mixed together with dairy in the first place. So in other words, I need 60 times the amount of the entire piece of meat and not just 60 times the amount of the milk that fell in the meat, even though I have enough meat. I have 60 times the amount of meat from the original little bit of milk that fell into that one piece of meat. Why is that? Because the first piece of meat is considered to be completely prohibited since it didn't have 60 times the amount of the milk that fell into it. Schaticha asma nases nevela. The entire piece is treated like a forbidden piece of food that's treated like a nevela. So Rabbeinu Tam has the opinion that this doesn't only apply with respect to basa v'chalav, to a little bit of milk that falls into a piece of meat, would apply even with respect to other isurim as well. I have some chazer flesh. I have a little bit of pig fat. Pig fat is usur. So I have a little bit of pig fat that falls into my mashed potatoes. And I have a little serving of mashed potatoes, and I don't have 60 times the amount of mashed potatoes to be able to nullify the pig fat. I can't recognize the pig fat. The whole mashed potatoes, it's all kind of, you know, fatty, has the oil, salt, whatever, and the pig fat just gets mixed in. I can't identify it, but I don't have 60 times the amount of mashed potatoes to nullify the pig fat. So now these mashed potatoes, according to Rabbeinu Tam, if these mashed potatoes would fall into a giant vat of mashed potatoes, where I certainly had 60 times the amount of the pig fat, if the giant vat doesn't have the 60 times the amount of the original mashed potatoes, so then it's all going to be aser. Why is that? Because I say chaticha nasei stadela, even if it's not basa v'chol, even if it's another iser. So Rabbeinu Ephraim disagrees, and Rabbeinu Ephraim says, no, I don't say it with respect to to other iserim. With other iserim, I only have to counteract the amount of the original iser and not the amount of the entire piece of food, the entire combination of food that the iser originally fell into. I wouldn't have to have shishim to have 60 measures the amount of that entire piece of food. Right? So says Tosfos, this is source Ches. Tosfos says in source Ches that according to the opinion of Rabbeinu Ephraim, we understand very well that which the Torah says when we conquered Midian, so they had a lot of utensils. And the utensils had to be kashered. Which utensils had to be kashered? Obviously not the kedera she'ena bas yom. If it was more than 24 hours, it didn't have to be kashered according to Torah law. That's a rabbinic law. The rabbi said that you have to kasher a kedera that's an ena bas yom because maybe you'll come to use a pot that's not 24 hours old. So it's within the first 24 hours. So the Torah says, what do you have to do? The Torah says you have to do hagolah. You have to go and you have to immerse the pots that were used by the minyanim. So what the Gemara in Avodah Zarah gives you all the different types of kashering that you do. You have to immerse those pots in hot boiling water in order to, we do this all the time. When we have Pesach kashering, right? You take these utensils and you immerse them in hot boiling water. Well, if you're going to immerse them in hot boiling water, you're going to have a problem. If it's a ben yomo, because whatever blia, whatever absorption was inside of the utensil, it's going to come out of the utensil, and it's all going to get mixed together with the water, and you're not always going to have 60 times the measure of the water to counteract all of the absorptions that were inside the walls of the utensil. We have to assume that if forbidden food was cooked inside of the utensil, maybe it spread throughout all the walls of the utensil. So if I have teeny tiny utensils and I immerse them in giant utensils and I have a lot of water inside the giant utensils, maybe I will have 60 times the measure of the wall space or the wall volume that was in the forbidden utensil. But if I have one giant utensil, that's the biggest utensil of them all, so how am I going to kasher it? I'll just pour boiling hot water in that utensil until it spills over the top. I'll maybe put a piece of rubber around the rim until it boils over the piece of rubber. I'm not going to have 60 times the amount of water. So if I don't have 60 times the amount of water, according to Rabbeinu Tam, all of that water is going to become chaticha nases tevela. So then that water is going to get reabsorbed back into the walls of the pot, and I won't have accomplished anything because whatever was kashered got de-kashered because all of the water then became a nevela, and all of that nevela water, all of that trafe water, then goes right back into the pot. So I'm not going to accomplish anything, but according to the opinion of Rabbeinu Ephraim, that it doesn't all become usa. So even if I don't have 60 times the measure of the prohibited absorptions, no problem. Probably if it's not 60 times the amount of the volume of the wall or the space of the wall, so the pot probably has 50 times the amount, 45 times the amount. So the majority of the forbidden absorptions are going to get nullified. Whatever little bit goes back into the utensil, you just do another hagolah, you do another kashering, pour more boiling hot water into the utensil, and that'll take care of whatever is left over, and therefore you'll be able to kasher that way. So so that would seem to work according to Rabbeinu Ephraim. So so it works out very well, says Tosfos, the way in which they kashered in the Midian, they were able to kasher a kedera bas yom. It works out according to Rabbeinu Ephraim. Doesn't work out perfectly according to Rabbeinu Tam. So Tosfos gives an answer. Tosfos says, okay, according to Rabbeinu Tam, maybe I could give a different answer. That maybe the Torah required kashering the utensils when they were ben yomo, it only meant the little utensils. The little utensils that would fit into the giant utensils that had shishim. Okay, but Tosfos doesn't imagine that if you hold that chaticha nasis levela the way that we do, bishari surim, even with respect to other prohibitions, that you would ever be able to kasher a ben yom. And that's in fact why we say you can't kasher a ben yom. And when we do kashering, like you come to the Pesach fair of the CRC, so we give you certain instructions. And one of the instructions is, we say, you can't have used your utensils, so that chametz utensils that you want to kasher for Pesach, make sure you haven't used them for 24 hours. Because we're afraid that the water is not going to be 60 times the amount of the utensils, the amount of the wall space of the utensils, and then the water will be chaticha nases levela, all the water will become asa, and we'll go back into the utensils, and we won't have accomplished anything. If it's an enabas yoma, so we're not going to have that problem, because the taste is going to be a detrimental taste. So therefore, that's going to be okay. So the question that is posed is, we have a very simple solution as to how we can make this work for a Kedei Rav Asyoma. Why? What's the simple solution? The simple solution is, based on the Mechaber, the Shulchan Aruch that I quoted before, that source Bob and Simon Sarieh, who says that if I have a meat and dairy, like our dishwasher case, right? If I have the meat and dairy utensils that are soaked together in this one big pot, which itself might be a dairy pot, and I have the meat pots, the greasy meat pot inside of this dairy pot, everything is mutter, as long as I pour aper, I pour ashes into the solution, so the ashes are a davar hapogim, it causes all the taste to be detrimental, and therefore, it never is going to become forbidden altogether. So the Shach asks the question, the Shach says, on this halacha, that the Shulchan Aruch made up. How do I know the Shulchan Aruch made up the halacha? Because he says so. The Shulchan Aruch in Source Bar says, you are Lee. It seems to me he made up the halacha. And the Shach says, woo! What gave him the right to make up halachas? You think just because you write a Shulchan Aruch, you can make up halachas? He said, I looked in the Beis Yosef, which the Shulchan Aruch wrote in his commentary, of Yosef Kara wrote in his commentary to Torah. He didn't make up this halacha there. Suddenly he wrote the Shulchan Aruch. He decided to slip this in and make up a halacha. I'm not going to let him get away with that. So the Shach said that, according to this idea of the Mechaber, it doesn't make sense that Tosros only, Thor said that the kashering a Kedei Rav Asyoma, it's a very big pot, only works according to Rabbeinu Chaim, and should work according to Rabbeinu Tam too. Because even according to Rabbeinu Tam, if I had a Kedei Rishayna Bas Yoma, I had a pot that was more than 24 hours old, I could certainly kasher. I don't worry about all the bleas, all the absorptions going into the water, and the water doesn't have 60 times the amount of the absorptions, because since it's no same time lefgam, so it's not going to prohibit the water. So too, if I put in a davar hapogim, according to the Mechaber, I put in some ammonium, I put in some heavy concentration of dishwasher detergent, so that it's going to become inedible, so I should be able to kasher ben yomo as well. So the Shach says, oh, the fact that Tosas didn't come up with this idea shows that it's not so. So the Pre-Kaddish says that's not really a kasha on the ruling of the Mechaber, because it could be that Tosus was only talking about how you kasher when there is no other substance, no other foreign substance which is introduced to the pot. But if indeed you would introduce a foreign substance to the pot, you would introduce some soapy solution or something like that, then you would be able to kasher that way. So that's how many poskim assume that you could even kasher a Kedei Rav Asyoma. And this comes up. Sometimes we have factories where we have to kasher things, and we can only kasher if it's within the 24 hours. They can't leave the equipment unused for a full 24-hour period. So in order to kasher within the 24-hour period, we put a davar hapogim. We put something that's going to create a very rancid taste. It's going to make it taste really, really bad, or smell really, really bad. Everything that's absorbed in the utensil is going to be considered to be detrimental in taste, and it's not going to prohibit the water, even if I don't have 60 times the measure of the water when I'm kashering, and therefore you can kasher in this particular fashion. That's what kasher's agencies sometimes do. Sometimes you have caterers that have to kasher a hotel, and they have to do it because they can't leave the utensils unused for 24 hours. They have to rely upon this device. So you have to make sure that you have a real davar hapogim. You have something that really creates a bad taste. How can you make sure that you have the requisite bad taste? First of all, how does this mechanism work? So according to there are two different approaches towards this. One is the approach of the placey, that source test, and says, Simon Hey Sipkot and Dalin, says that the idea is that the Gamla Rabbeinu Tam, this is the last two lines, you could say even according to Rabbeinu Tam, they could have done a Hagola, they could have kashered the clay minyan when they were within the first 24 hours, by first putting in May Aper, they put in ashy water, they put in, you know, some sort of a pogame solution, some sort of a soapy or ash-ridden solution that's going to cause the everything that is absorbed inside of the utensil to become detrimental in taste. And then afterwards, they would do hagala. Afterwards, they would do a full-fledged hagala. They would then place this pot in hot boiling water, or they would pour hot boiling water in the pot and have it go over the sides, and then we wouldn't worry. Just like after 24 hours, you don't worry about what comes out from the inside of the pots, because it would be a detrimental taste there too. You created a detrimental taste within the 24 hours. That's one explanation. The Chazon Ish says, that source Yud in Yoredeya Simchov Gimel Sivkot and Aleph, he says, you can't really be sure that that's going to work, that just because you put a Dover HaPogim, that it's necessary. He says, Dover Pogim means that anything that comes out of the absorption is going to receive a detrimental taste. But how do I know that everything's gonna go into the inside of the pots? So that all of the what was absorbed inside of the pots is all going to receive a detrimental taste? Maybe that's not necessarily going to be true. So he says the only way that you can assure that it will be true is if you not only put a soapy solution in that is hot, but it has to be so hot that it's boiling temperature, so the first time that you put it in, it's going to be Hagola temperature. It's going to be like 212 degrees, as opposed to, let's say, according to the Crazy, it could be the first time around, it could be 160 degrees. It could be Yatzeledes temperature, and it's going to penetrate inside the pot. It's like cooking, so I cook it, it's good enough. According to the Chazon Ish, cooking might not be good enough. It might not cause the detrimental taste to penetrate inside of the utensil, so therefore I need to do Hagola. What does Hagola do? Hagola, when I use boiling water, it's going to bring out everything that was embedded inside of the utensil, and then it's going to confront the soapy solution that's inside of the utensil, and then the taste is going to become detrimental at that point in time. So according to the Chazon Ish, I wouldn't even have to do this twice. I just do one time. I do a Hagala one time. So we're machmir for both shittos, that we generally will assume that you should have the first time you should use the soapy water in order to create a detrimental taste, and you do it even with Hagala temperature, and then you, after you've done that the first time with the soapy water, then you use a second time that you do Hagala, that you use boiling water when it's not a soapy solution. What's the reason for that? So one explanation for that is there is an opinion that you can't kasher with shar mashkim. You can only kasher with water, but you can't kasher with other types of liquids. So if you have a very soapy solution, maybe that's viewed that it's an outside liquid. So some of the achronim say this is a reason why we require sort of two washings, because maybe the first one was only good to bring out the detrimental taste. That's what the Chavos Da'as says, that source Yud Aleph, so that you now it's considered to be a detrimental taste, but I still need a second time so that I'm not going to have any of these other concerns. I'll just have a two-time kashering. That's what a number of the different sources over here talk about. Pri Chodesh talks about doing that as well. When we have to kasher something which is a ben yomo, so it's very important that we have to make a determination that it is a detrimental taste. And how can we make sure that it is a detrimental taste? So the way we can make sure it's a detrimental taste is by tasting it. But who's going to taste it? Who's going to engage in this type of a tasting exercise? So the Shulchan Aruch in the source Tezvav says that if I have an iser, if I have some type of a prohibited substance which is got mixed together in a permissible substance, and I want to make a determination, it used to be, or really it still is, that let's say I don't have 60 measures of the permitted substance, but I know for sure that you were not able to taste the prohibited substance. So then there's no problem of tam ki'ikar. I could just follow the majority rule that the prohibited taste is nullified. The problem is I can't taste it because maybe the prohibited taste is discernible. So it used to be you could get a yitameno nachu. You get a non-Jew to taste it. The non-Jew, maybe according to some opinions, the non-Jew has to be a baker, a cook, a chef, somebody who is distinguished and knowledgeable in this area, or who's not going to want to mess with his reputation by giving the wrong answer. So you get a kepela arma. So says the Rama in Simen Sadi Ches in Yoredeya Beinogim Achshav L'smoch Al Avodas Kol Galinim. We don't rely nowadays upon a non-Jew because maybe it's only like a nuanced sort of taste that you would discern, and maybe they'll get it wrong, and it won't harm their reputation, because they'll say, oh, I tried on, and I didn't notice. I made a mistake. So they have an easy way out, so therefore we don't rely upon them. But the Shulchan Aruch indicates otherwise, elsewhere, if the taste is something that could be conducted by a Jew, so then we can rely upon a Jew. What would be the case? That's in Siman Sadibah. If I have a dove charit, I cut a radish with a meat knife. So if I cut a radish with a meat knife, and there's a possibility of a transmission of taste from the knife on the meat knife into the radish, and then I'm not allowed to eat the radish with dairy. So that's how we generally assume. But let's say that you you very badly want to use this radish with dairy. So says the Shulchan Aruch that one way you could do it is you take a taste test, lo yebel tam basar, and you determine that it doesn't have a meat test. So then you can just rinse it off and it's going to be okay. So the Shach says we don't rely upon this even for a Jew to taste it, but we do rely upon a bidyevet. So somebody would then take this radish and cook the radish in dairy, put the radish in dairy, and now I have somebody else tastes the remainder of the radish and determines that the radish doesn't have a meat taste. So we can assume whatever was cooked with dairy also didn't have a meat taste, and therefore the whole solution is going to be mutter. He brings three opinions. The opinion of the Lavush, who says that we don't rely upon a taste test even b'dieved. The opinion of the Rosh and the Rashba and the Shulchan Aruch that seem to indicate that we rely upon a Jewish taste test even l'chatzchila when the solution is mutter. And the opinion of the Shach that we don't rely upon it l'chatzchila, but b'dieved we would rely upon it. So when we rely upon a taste test with respect to a Jew, where a Jew is going to taste something, so we say, so too, if I need to determine, let's say, that meat was salted, and I don't know if it was salted or not, so you could put it like the Frikadosh and others in the Taz say that you could put it on your tongue. You can't swallow it, because maybe it's really usur. It wasn't salted meat, in which case it would be prohibited to eat. But you could put it on your tongue, and you could see whether you taste the salt. And if you taste the salt on your tongue, you're not swallowing anything, so then that would be okay. You could say, oh, I taste the salt, and therefore it's okay. So that's if I'm tasting salt. If I need to taste salt, so then that would be permissible. But what if it's going to be something which is what if it's something where I'm not necessarily, it's not salt, it's not something which is so obvious that I would be able to tell if it's salty or not. I need to tell whether a food is tastes like meat or tastes like dairy, so then I have to actually swallow it. Then it would be necessary to actually swallow it. So where do you find this discussed? So you find this discussed in the pre-Megadim, in Siman Tzadifes Sifkatan Beis. If you take a look at the top of page 5. So the top of page 5 says the pre-Megadim, in a Roy Lahaskir Bekat, I have to mention to you something which the Rivash says, She'ef she'erinu somchin al kepela below achilo gemura. We don't rely upon this type of taste test even for a Jew, even for a Jewish chef, unless he's going to actually eat it. He's going to eat it and he's going to swallow it. Otherwise, we're not going to rely upon it. If it's something which you can tell just through the saltiness, you're going to be mekel, so then you can tell, then that's good enough. But if it's something where you have to, you know, determine whether there's a flavor, so the flavor, that's going to require you to actually swallow it. Imsein elamedin midvarav, so we can learn from this, that the tamenu goy, that when we used to rely on an anju, I know lecho v'libloa, that it would have to be that he's actually eating it and he's going to swallow it. V'nafka minli didan. And this has ramifications for us, timas yisoh bina nachila mamash, that when you have a Jew doing a taste test, unless it's something where I have to be worried that maybe it's usur, like that maybe the meat wasn't salted and I can actually taste it and figure it out based on tasting it with my tongue, and if I don't discern saltiness, so I'm going to be machmir, so that's okay. But if it's otherwise something where I need to know whether it has a certain type of taste, in order to know whether I can be mako, like a dove or hapo game, so it sounds like you're going to have to actually swallow it. Now, sometimes a dove or hapo game is like I have a boiler water that had some soapy detergent in it from some non-Jewish company and had been used for a non-kosher product. So then I can't swallow it. So then I'd have to actually just put it in the mouth and spit it out and rely upon that, but then it would have to have a really, really bad taste in order to be obvious, in order to be discernible. However, sometimes you have things like a dishwasher, where in a dishwasher, the soapy solution which is used in the dishwasher is not really so, if you follow the advice of how much a soapy solution you're going to put into the dishwasher, that they tell you to do. And usually the shilos that we get are after the fact. Somebody cooked meat and dairy dishes together, and they want to know whether the dishes are permissible. So one of the major considerations is, was the water soapy enough? So we have to determine whether this degree of soapiness, which is not necessarily super soapy, is going to be reliable. And for that, we have to really taste it. So that's what we were doing in the picture, getting back to the picture. So it wasn't if it would have been a case of something which had tons and tons of detergent, or it was something which was poisonous, so we wouldn't have swallowed it because, you know, we're not interested in poisoning ourselves, contrary to, you know, perhaps appearances in the picture. But, you know, we look cheerful enough in the picture. Nobody's looking to, like, you know, to kill themselves. So then we wouldn't have been able to swallow it, but we wouldn't have needed to swallow it. But in this case, we were talking about a very slight solution of soap, which is the amount that they recommend that you put into the dishwasher. And for that, we needed to really swallow it. Or you might have situations where you have a company that wants the kasher kedera bas yoma, and they can't necessarily put tons of solution, tons of soap or dishwasher detergent, because it's going to be very expensive to put that much every single time they're going to kosher the kasher the equipment. The equipment is very voluminous, and therefore they want to be able to get away with as little as possible. Also, given that we sometimes are relying upon one koshering alone, don't always have the luxury of doing two different kosherings. There are opinions, like Rabbi Yisrael Belsky, Zichrono Levracha, said that if the solution is only has a little bit of soap in it, and it's not, you know, it doesn't change its appearance and it doesn't change its thickness, and it's basically the same consistency as water, so you can rely upon that more readily for koshering purposes. So therefore, it's better that there not be a tremendous amount of soap. So that's the reason why, when we were testing this particular solution, it wasn't, number one, so obvious just by putting it to our lips, putting it to our tongue, that it was sufficient pogame, and it was something that really needed, according to these halachas, that really needed to be swallowed. So that's the reason why, when we did our taste test, we actually had to swallow it. And in fact, there were two different solutions. One solution, I had to drink like three times because it was a very close call. I said, it's too close a call. We can't rely upon this to be a dove pogame. And then the other one, I said, this is really bad. It was great, you know, so that we could rely upon. Now, the question is, yes.
But we said before that for pogame, like with the example of the bread thrown in the well, as long as it makes water taste a little bit less, a little bit worse, because that's enough to be called pogame and not a problem of kashrus with the bread thrown in on the water. So if that's considered pogame, makes it a little bit less, the water. It's still drinkable, it's still water. So why don't we apply the same, you know, definition to this? Okay, so it's not so thick and soapy, but it makes it a little bit. Why don't we use the same definition for there?
So again, there's a subjective test and an objective test. So different types of foods, like orange juice, milk. So, you know, milk might make orange juice not taste so good, but milk will make chocolate taste, you know, a lot better. You'll have chocolate milk. So there are different types of foods where it will subjectively change or be different based on the type of food that it's affecting. But if you want something that's going to have a detrimental effect on all foods, like, for example, the equivalent of an absorption that was in a utensil for 24 hours, so then it has to be objectively more foul tasting, so that it's going to mess everything up. So that's the reason why this has to have a more foul tasting type of taste. So now, in if you look at the source of Gimel, so there's another issue over here, which is that do you need to make a bracha? Do you need to make a bracha? As a general rule, the Gemara says, there's a brisa that says, if I'm only tasting something, so it doesn't require a bracha. It doesn't require a bracha. Shulchan Aruch, in Hilchos Birchas Peiros Siman Reish Yud, Or HaChaim, says, Tatoim is Tatasha and Sark Levarek Ad Revias. If I'm tasting something, even if it's a perfectly good thing to taste, you don't have to make a bracha if I'm only tasting to see what the taste is. But there is another opinion that says, Shim Hu Bolo tone bracha. If you're going to swallow it, you're not just going to taste it and spit it out. So then it is going to require a bracha. And we only exempt the person from tasting if they're going to spit it out. So if I say, like the prima godim, that in these types of situations, I actually am going to have to swallow, certainly when it's a close call, and I don't have to worry about poison or something like that, and I want to be able to make a determination, otherwise if I wouldn't be able to tell just by putting it on my tongue, if it's a very light solution, I wouldn't be able to be makel for people to say you can kasher them with this, or that you could be makel if you wash the meat and dairy dishes together in a dishwasher like this. So we want to help people. So the only way to do that is if we're going to get a good taste if we're going to be swallowing. So then, if we're not spitting it out, there is an opinion that says that you would have to make a bracha. If you take a look at the Mishnah Berurah, Siman Reish Yud, Sifkat and Yudes, says the Magen Avraham cholik al Shulchan Aruch Ramos related to Bolei the Kuliyam Machayev LeBarach, that the Magen Avraham actually holds against both the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, and says if you're going to swallow, then everybody holds that you require a bracha. So therefore, we are a little bit worried about this. So when we started doing these taste tests, at least during my tenure, a number of years ago, and I did it with Rabbi Ephraim Friedman Shlita, so we were both concerned that maybe if it's not a dava pogim, if it's not something which is inedible, if it turns out that the water is actually digestible, so maybe we really need to make a bracha. So we had like a suffik bracha. So what do you do if you have a suffik bracha? So as a general rule, if you're drinking water, so there's a halakha that if you're only drinking water, like for example, to swallow a pill, so you don't have to make bracha on water. So here we're talking about water, but it's not exact water. It's like soapy water. Maybe soapy water is better, probably a little worse. But what is the real halakha? So you take a look at source above. We're now on page 6. So the Gemara in Brachos Daf Mem Daan Mem Beis says, that if you drink water, just in order to save yourself from choking, so you don't make a bracha. And so to we assume you're drinking water just to swallow a pill, you don't make a bracha. So Shulchan Aruch, and passing this halacha, Siman Reish Daled, and Orach Chaim says, if you drink water because you're thirsty, so then of course you make a shakel. But if you're only doing it for other reasons, like for medical reasons, because you were choking on something, you drink water to make the food go down, so then you don't make a bracha. So says the Mishnah Berurah, this is only if you're not enjoying the water. This is only when if you're not enjoying the water. But if you're drinking other types of drinks that you're going to enjoy, even if you also have an ulterior purpose, so that you would make a bracha. As it says in the Mishnah Berurah at the end over here, if you drink water in the morning because medically you're supposed to do it, so then you don't make a bracha. But if you're also doing it because you happen to be thirsty, so you make a bracha. So Rabbi Friedman and I had this dilemma. We're drinking this water and maybe the solution is bad, in which case it's not really a shaila. Maybe the solution is good. And maybe we're actually thirsty. Do we know for sure that? Could we say 100% that we're not thirsty? So therefore, we can't really, know for sure whether it's appropriate to make a bracha, not make a bracha. And if we would just make a bracha on another cup of water, so maybe this is also utilitarian. We're making a bracha on a cup of water, so we'll be able to do a taste test. So according to many poskim, you wouldn't make a bracha. So we wanted to be out of a suffik bracha situation where maybe we should make a bracha, maybe we shouldn't make a bracha. So we had to figure out what to do. And in fact, you look at the Sharet Siyum. Shout Siyan Simon Sivkat and Lamed Bav over there, close to Yerushalmi, that if you're drinking water, really that has a medical purpose. May Mayano Shemashalshalin, it's meant to loosen the bowels. Let's just leave it at that. Imshosa Osam Gamut Samu, even then, if you're also drinking it because you're thirsty, you will make a bracha. So therefore, what do you do? So if you look in Tosos, in bracha, stuff Mem Heyam and Aleph, so Tosos says, about Sham Ashkim, this is what the Mishnah Berurah was getting at before, about Sham Ashkim, second line, Shiliolam Aguf Nenemehen, if you have drinks that are not water, that are like recreational drinks, what we might call Chama Medina, that you would serve like an honored guest because it's like so tasty and enjoyable, right? Shalom gufanen emayen, the kol inyan, a mevarek vapil kanakti umtsa. So you would always make a bracha, even if you're only drinking it for ulterior purposes. If it's like, for example, what? So let's take a look at the Piskei Tshuva, so achayim yesh kosrim, shebechol inyan simen reish dalad. There's those who therefore write, if you're going to be drinking more than a revius of water, certainly if you're drinking the solution like we have to do, in order to make a taste test for the Kedera Bas Yoma Kashering, for dishwasher cases where you have dishwasher fluid and there's a shiloh after the fact and so forth, and you're not drinking it for the purpose of satisfying your thirst. So then the best idea, the best eitzah, is levarech amashke machal achir, to make a shahakol on a different drink of food, kashir. Levarech bread and parshas lekarim liftu amayim, and you have in mind that you're going to exempt the water. So that's the reason in the picture, getting back to the picture, why on the table you will see the Coke, because Coke is the taste that refreshes, and therefore we were comfortable enough that you can always make a bracha on Coke, even if it's only brought to the table for utilitarian purposes. So we started making a shahakol on the Coke, and only after we made a shahakol on the Coke did we engage in this other taste test in which we had to drink and swallow the water and make these determinations for the benefit, of course, of Klal Yisrael. But this is what we do at the Chicago Rabbinical Council. Okay.
Hopefully no one has any concerns about if something's poisoning. Yeah.